This is Dishin' Dirt with Gary Pickren, South Carolina's only podcast dedicated to the real estate agent craft. And now, the host of Dishin' Dirt, Gary Pickren.
And greetings and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Dishin' Dirt. I'm your often opinionated but rarely wrong host, Gary Pickren, coming to you from Blair Keto Pickren Castellan in beautiful downtown Columbia, South Carolina, this the second week of January 2023. So this week is probably the last episode of the series I'm going to do called Distressed and Stressed series. We've examined the math of loans, frauds, the new CCRA contract, pre-foreclosure. And this week, we're going to cover the five things that can actually cause your closing to be delayed or canceled. Erica Librand's back yet again. She's Blair Cato's title attorney, and she's going to give us her list of the five things that she sees as a title attorney that constantly cause delays or cancellations. Everything you need to know about it, why it happens, how we can fix it, and move forward. Now, I actually might try to add one more stress and de-stress episode. I might try to do one with Erica on bond for titles, owner financing, and things of that nature. But as soon as we finish that one, I am going to shift gears, and we're going to spend a lot of time in the next couple of weeks talking about the state of the market. Probably do a couple of shows about where the market has been in 2022, where the experts see that it is going in 2023, so you can help plan for your year. But today, I want to go ahead and start with our top five things that can cause your closings to be delayed or even canceled. So we're going to jump right in with Erica Librand on our episode this week. All right, welcome back, Erica. You are now the guest star who has appeared the most times on Dish and Dirt. So that means you're like semi-famous in like this very small, tiny little niche of people.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, you might be famous amongst like five people, something like
that. Go me.
Well, let's go ahead and get started with your list, because I do think this is a very important topic today, because there are a lot of things that can delay closing. And once a real estate agent works hard and gets something under contract, the last thing anybody wants is for it to fall through because of something with title. I hope agents all understand that if they don't get paid, we don't get paid either. Title insurance doesn't get paid. Nobody gets paid. So our goal as closing attorneys is to make sure it gets closed so we can get it paid. But it's also to make sure that it is closed properly, because the last thing you want to do is close something with a title issue and just hope that no one ever finds it, because that will be a big mess in the future. So let's first start with kind of an overview. When we talk about title problems, what do we mean? Why do these things stop closings?
So title problems are going to be things that we uncover after we've done the title search. They're going to be any manner of thing that creates what we call a cloud on title. It could be an outstanding interest. It could be liens on title. It could be things that could become potential problems down the road, and the title insurance company is not interested in insuring them for that reason. Basically, what it means for purposes of your contract and for your closing is title problems mean that we don't have marketable title. And of course, we know that the contract requires, in most circumstances, marketable title. And so if you have a title problem that appears as part of the title search, you're then going to have a problem with meeting the terms of that contract.
So why don't you tell us the difference between insurable title and marketable title?
First of all, marketable title means you have clear title. There are no defects, no clouds on title. The individual who is selling the property is the record fee owner of the property. There aren't any outstanding interests, and there aren't any potential liens, problems with the survey, anything of that nature. So marketable title is your clean, ready to go title under your contract. And I do want to point out that marketable title doesn't necessarily mean there are no exceptions on your title insurance policy. So on an owner's title insurance policy, you're going to see exceptions for things that are of record that the purchaser is expected to know as a result of the title search. So these would be things like utility easements, you know, power line easements, things of that nature, covenants and restrictions in a neighborhood, things of that nature. So those don't affect your ability to convey marketable title. They're just sort of notice for the owner.
What about insurable title?
So insurable title is like one step down. Insurable title is where there may be a cloud or a defect on title, but the title insurance company has agreed to assume the risk associated with that particular issue and has agreed to insure the title regardless of the fact that it is, in fact, not clear. So this would be something where you've heard somebody say, hey, we got affirmative coverage over this issue. Hey, we've got this minor fence projection. We were able to get affirmative coverage. And so that means that if that was to become an issue down the road for the buyer, then they would be able to make a title claim on their title insurance policy. And the title company has already agreed to insure any kind of problem that would result from that.
So when people hear title issue, their first thing is, well, why can't the title insurance companies just take care of it? So walk us through why title insurance companies don't just take care of everything. And even if they did agree to take care of something, why that could still be an issue for closing.
Title insurance companies are much like all other insurance companies. They do a risk analysis associated with certain issues. In some cases, if they had previously insured over that particular issue, they sort of have an obligation to continue insuring that type of situation. But they don't necessarily want to take the risk to insure some things that they know are likely to become a problem down the road and cost them a bunch of money to fix or make go away. So the idea of let's have the title insurance company just take care of it, that's not always an issue or an option, because the title insurance company is going to review that risk and see the risk to be too high for them to be willing to insure it, and they're going to want it fixed. Now, even if we were to get coverage, affirmative coverage over whatever the issue is, that doesn't mean you have marketable title, right? You have insurable title. And so that means that if you as a buyer, if your buyer was willing to accept the condition of the title being that there is some kind of defect, but the title insurance company is willing to provide the affirmative coverage, when they go to sell, your buyer goes to sell, they may have to convince the next buyer to accept the condition of title being insurable and not marketable, assuming that that issue hasn't resolved itself in the interim. Even though we get coverage, even though we get, you know, affirmative coverage or the title company agrees to insure regardless of the defect, that doesn't mean that you have marketable title. It doesn't mean you have clean title. And it doesn't mean that your buyer won't have a problem down the road.
What I want all the real estate agents to understand is it's ultimately the buyer's decision in that situation, because the contract calls for marketable title. And if, in fact, there's not marketable title and insurable title, your buyer may decide it's an issue they don't really care about. However, they may find an issue that they have insurable title, even though you and I may find it to be the most ridiculous thing. We may have a set buyer who says, I don't care. I don't want to buy it because I don't want anything less than marketable title. I'll give you an example. We had one time where a patio in a patio neighborhood was about 6 inches over the property line, and this buyer refused to buy the property unless the seller went out and had somebody get a concrete saw and move the patio 6 inches. And they literally cut 6 inches of the patio off, which actually made their patio 6 inches smaller, but that was the only way they were going to buy it, because they did not want to be over the property line. Now, you and I at the time thought it was absolutely ludicrous, but yeah, that's what that consumer wanted. Now, we've also seen things where title has been very bad and we're saying, I would not buy it based on this. And we've had buyers say, I don't care. I'm going to buy it anyway. I want to move forward. So ultimately, it's the buyer's decision. The other thing I want to make sure everybody knows before we get into your list is, with marketable title, there is this belief that if Blair Cato or somebody says the title is not marketable, that if they go find another lawyer who says it is, that somehow it magically fixed the problem. The same problem still exists. It's just a matter of opinion as to whether it's marketable or not. So if there is a closing and we opine that it's not marketable and you want to buy it anyway, that's fine with us. Going to another attorney to close it isn't going to all of a sudden magically make it marketable because that lawyer says, oh, well, he thinks it's marketable. And we've actually had that situation take place before.
Right. And I did want to also point out that if your seller has been notified that you have that they have a title issue on their property and they're not interested in fixing it, and now they've found some other lawyer who's willing to close it without, you know, having it as an exception on the buyer's policy or whatever it is, when that issue becomes a problem for your buyer, they're then going to be looking at your warranties that you provided to them and your deed. You're not going to just get away with it just because you've switched lawyers and they're willing to insure it without an exception on the policy. You're still on notice of this issue and conveyed it without the required disclosure and ability for the buyer to decide whether or not they wanted to accept that the condition of that title.
All right, let's move on. because we do have a list of five issues that you, as our title attorney at Blair Cato, you're seeing these issues multiple times. These are issues you believe that cause closings to either be delayed or possibly even canceled. And nobody wants a closing to get canceled. And believe it or not, no lawyer wants them to delay. We want to get them in and close as soon as possible, just like the agent. So
that's right.
Let's talk about item number one. What is the first item, the first issue on your list that you're seeing that causes delays for closings?
Okay, so item number one is going to be estates. And really, this is probably should be estates or deceased property owners, because more often than not, when we're seeing this be a cause of delay, it's the result of an estate not being filed. So when you have a property owner that has passed away, their interest in the property has to be legally dealt with. In some limited circumstances, if they owned property with another person as joint tenants with rights of survivorship, an estate is not necessary. That's a very limited circumstance. We still would need a death certificate in order to move forward with that transaction. But if they didn't own title as joint tenants with rights of survivorship with a living owner, then they have to have the estate, their estate probated in the county in which the property lies in order to sell the property, let the PR sell the property or their heirs sell the property.
PR meaning personal representative.
That's right. So a lot of people think, hey, mom and dad own the property. Dad passed away. Mom is still living. Mom wants to sell the property. All the children want mom to get the property. And so mom's going to sell the property. And we get to a point where we realize, okay, deceased property owner has passed away and he doesn't have an estate. Also, he didn't have a will. And so now we have this long, lengthy, delayed process where now that an estate has to be filed. The person has to be appointed as personal representative. And when there's no will, that's a process to determine who of the heirs is supposed to be the PR. And then if there is no will, or even if there is a will and that will doesn't specify that the personal representative has the power to sell property, then a petition with the probate court has to be filed. And the petition is the petition to sell the property. And everybody who's a potential heir has to be noticed of this, in addition to anybody, any company that holds a mortgage on the property has to be notified of this. And then there's got to be a hearing and then a court order. So that can be cause a lengthy delay if their estate isn't filed, or if there is no will, or if they haven't gotten the power to sell in the will. All of that can cause a big delay. We also see a lot of issues with estates where the estate was filed and there was a will, or there wasn't, but a deed of distribution has been issued. So everybody thinks, good, we're all set. We got it taken care of. We're ready to go. Turns out that the will gave the property to both brother and sister, but the deed of distribution was only to sister. Well, that's an issue because the brother and sister probably made a private agreement, which is part of the probate code, allows them to do that. And they said, well, brother's going to get this property and sister's going to get this property. So they just did deeds of distribution to the individuals. Problem is that the way that the law works is a person who is a devisee under a will or an heir in a situation where there is no will automatically inherits the property at the time of the death of the property owner. And so at the point where brother and sister are both the ones that are devisees under the will, sister has an interest in the property regardless of what she has agreed to with her brother. And so if the deed of distribution is just to brother, sister has to give us a quit claim deed in order to clear title to that property. As you can probably imagine, if that estate had been filed 6 years ago and now brother and sister are on the outs and sister doesn't want to have anything to do with brother, getting that deed from sister can certainly be problematic.
Right. And so in some limited cases, like with the estate, when we go back to talking about somebody dying and then we need to get an estate, in some situations, we can get all of the heirs to sign a deed to avoid the hearing, but that's not something that can happen every time. And there's some parameters that we'd have to look at for that, but that is something that might be able to speed it up. Is that correct?
That's right.
So the delay and the cost of this can range from a matter of a week or two of getting somebody appointed and getting maybe a deed done, or if there's a will that allows it, to it could be months if we have to have a hearing. And once you have a hearing, then you're talking thousands of dollars to get this taken care of. So,
right.
What do agents
and not even and even with the deeds, Gary, you know, we had one that just closed a couple weeks ago, but we had, I think it was seven individuals, they were heirs with no will situation, who all had to sign this quitclaim deed. And one of them was like in Minnesota, and one was in New Jersey. And so it took us like 2 months just to get everybody on board to sign the deeds and then get them to the people who needed to sign and then get them back to us so that we could record it. So, you know, making sure you know what's going on with the estate and the interest of who the people were in the estate, the heirs, is very important.
And I'm not going to get into it today, but this would even bring into heirs property where I'm literally dealing with grandma and granddad on the property. Granddad died. Grandma somehow got it then grandma died. And at this point now there's like 8 brothers and sisters, of which 4 have already died, which some had wives, some had husbands, some had kids, some did not. Some of them that had kids, the kids already passed away as well. And so we're coming down to like 1/64th interest trying to get people to sign deeds. And I think we're up to needing about 18 or 19 different people to sign the deed to get this done. And this, I've been working on this one since summertime, and I'm not sure it's going to get done anytime soon. So there is a lot that goes into the estate. So we could do a whole show on estates, but being on time, we're trying to talk about our top 5 things. Let's move over to number 2. What's the number 2 thing?
Number 2, we've been seeing a lot of tax sales lately, a lot of tax deeds. So tax sale is when the property has, the property taxes have not been paid, and the county then sells the property. There's a whole process and procedure for it, but eventually what happens, the county sells the property for the delinquent taxes to be repaid for that. And somebody ends up with a deed about a year and a half-ish or so after that tax sale occurs. And sometimes people think, you know what, this is a great thing. I just bought this nice piece of property for $1,500 and I'm going to put it up and I'm going to list it for $100,000 and I'm going to make a bunch of money off of it. And the problem is that getting those deeds from the county tax collector or from the forfeited land commission, who ends up with title if nobody buys it at the tax sale, that's just not clean title. It's not clear title. It's not marketable. It's not even insurable in most circumstances. And so we're seeing a lot of that this lately, where people are selling property that they purchased through a tax sale. And in order to clear that issue, we either have to get a deed or deeds from the defaulting taxpayer, who might be deceased, and then you've got a whole host of issues with the state. So that's, again, how we go back to that. Or we have to file a quiet title action. Quiet title action is a civil lawsuit that's filed at the courthouse. That is going to be a minimum of 3 months turnaround. More often, we're seeing about 4 to 6, as long as nobody's getting involved and contesting it. I think the big issue that we're seeing there is when there's tax title in this chain of title and the parties don't know about it and they're not willing to accept no title insurance, most of the time those contracts cancel because it's just going to take a really long time to end up getting clear title, either through the deeds with the defaulting taxpayers or through that quiet title action.
So if I was to go to a tax sale, buy property at tax sale, successfully wait my 1 year redemption period, and I get the deed from the treasurer, am I subject to all the liens, judgments, taxes, and everything else that's subject on that property?
Absolutely.
Right.
So that's the other thing. If there were judgments against the defaulting taxpayer that have not expired, tax liens, mortgages, any of that kind of stuff survives that tax sale. There's some limited thoughts on mortgages where the mortgage company may have received notice and whether or not those survive. We take the position that they do, and most of our title insurance companies would as well. But this is not a situation where, like with judgments, for example, which we're going to talk about next, they only last for 10 years. So once 10 years passes, you're all good. This is not that same situation. There are some limited circumstances where a title insurance company is willing to insure a tax sale if it's been a long period of time, 10 or more years. But even still, in some of those situations, they're not willing to do that. So this is one of those things that has to be fixed. There's no other way around it.
So when people talk about getting property at tax sales, I think most people need to understand people don't lose property at tax sales that have good financial backgrounds. People losing property at tax sales usually happen for 1 or 2 reasons. They didn't know they owned the property because they inherited it, which is a situation for very few of them. But most of them just didn't have the money to pay the taxes. And if they didn't have the money to pay the taxes, they probably also have liens and judgments and all kind of other stuff that's going to make the property. So I think there's this misconception that you just walk down to the courthouse and buy all these properties for $1,000 and then you can sell them for $100,000, because there are going to be liens. But even outside of the liens, I think it's very important the agents understand as well that when that deed is issued from the treasurer's office to the winning bidder, it's just a quick claim deed. And all the county saying is, or the city saying, or whoever's doing the foreclosure, the tax sale is, we don't know what the title is, but whatever it is, y'all got it. Good, bad, and ugly. And because of that, there's no warranty deeds involved. And because there's no warranty deeds involved, that's where the title insurance comes in and says, look, we don't have a warranty deed. All we got is this quick claim deed that says, whatever we got, we're giving it to you. And so that issue has to be resolved. Now, the good thing, if you're lucky, and this is a big lucky, and rarely does it happen, if you can find the defaulting taxpayer, you can say, I'll pay you a couple $100 if you'll sign a deed saying you don't have any interest in the property anymore, you're done with it. And then we can move forward, because the only person who has a chance to object to the tax sale being done wrong is that defaulting taxpayer. So if they will sign a deed saying that they're making no claim, then we're good to go. But outside of that, it's going to be a quiet title action. We're talking 16, 18 months.
Right. And even if you get that quick claim deed from the defaulting taxpayer, you're still going to have to deal with their liens and judgments and mortgages and things like that.
Right. That's not going to end that. It's just going to make the claim that it just clears up the claim, but it doesn't clear up any liens.
Right.
So, yeah. So a lot of things there. I would tell everyone on a tax sale, if somebody tells you they got a tax deed, you need to immediately pick up the phone and call Erica or myself, and let's give you some advice on what to do at that point. Listing properties that are in tax that just came through tax sale, probably you're going to find yourself winding up in a situation where it's not going to close. You're going to have a buyer who's going to be very mad at you, particularly if you signed a contract offering warranty, general warranty deed, or you're offering marketable title because you don't have either. So before you even sign a contract to sell a property that's a tax sale, there's some modifications that need to be done to the contract, such as making an insurable title and noting that it is a quick claim deed and there's nothing more.
As a clarification, it's not even insurable in most situations. This would be a no title insurance situation in almost every circumstance.
Yes. So moving on to number three, I think you said it was going to be judgments and liens. Let's talk about that next.
That's right. So judgments and liens. Now, this could be a concern for both the buyer and the seller. Buyer, if they have a mortgage lender that they're using in order to purchase the property. In these circumstances, when a buyer has a lender and they're using a lender to purchase property, that is what we call a purchase money mortgage. And purchase money mortgages are afforded lien priority as to the property itself, as to any prior or pre-existing liens of the owner, the buyer only. Okay. So in those circumstances, that is not a title insurance issue. So if I find a pre-existing lien or judgment in the name of the buyer on one of these loan transactions, for the most part, I'm not going to have to require that those be paid in order for it to have clear title, because I know that my lender, my mortgage that I'm insuring, will have lien priority. However, most lenders are going to want to see that matter taken care of before they'll give the clear to close on your buyer's loan. So when the lender finds out, hey, this buyer has $700,000 in judgments, they're going to be a whole lot less likely to want to go ahead and give the clear to close, even though they know that their mortgage would still have lien priority. So that's a buyer issue. Seller issue, of course, any judgments, any liens are going to operate as a lien against the property itself. So even if the seller had foreclosure and had a deficiency judgment entered against them 8 or 9 years ago, and that was on a different property, if they have a personal money judgment against them, that's going to be a lien against their current property that they own. All of those will have to be paid and satisfied of record before the closing can move forward. I did mention just a second ago that judgments and liens only operate as a lien against real property for a period of 10 years. So from the date of entry of that lien or judgment and 10 years forward, it technically expires at that point. So no longer will we require the satisfaction of those liens and judgments once it hits that 10-year mark. But otherwise, if it's within that 10-year period and it's against our seller, it's going to have to be paid. It's going to have to be settled or satisfied. There are ways that we can help sellers. If they have a $100,000 judgment against them, maybe we can get the lien creditor to settle for $2,500 for a partial release of the judgment from this property.
What does that mean?
Partial release means that the lien will continue to operate as to any other property that the debtor owns, but that the creditor has agreed to release this particular piece of property they're trying to sell from the lien of that judgment for that payment, whatever they've agreed to accept. So the lien will still be out there. It doesn't get satisfied. It doesn't get released as to everything, but it would get released as to this particular piece of property. So we would have clear title.
When a closing attorney calls an agent and says, we have declared judgments, does that automatically mean, without a shadow of a doubt, these judgments apply to their client?
Oh, no. The way we search title is by name. So if you have Jason Smith, for example, there are lots of Jason Smiths, even from county to county across the state. And so we're going to probably find some liens and judgments that belong to a Jason Smith that may not be your Jason Smith. A lot of times that's why we reach out and ask for like the last four of the social or some other identifying features that we can help to rule out those judgments and liens to the extent that they do appear and they don't apply to our seller.
So when you have a buyer or seller who has a name like Michael Smith, which we have a spreadsheet of all the judgments against Michael Smith, I understand. Michael Jordan. Right. I remember doing a closing for a Michael Jordan, and there's page after page of judgments against people named Michael Jordan. You have to figure out if it's your Michael Jordan. So when you give us, if we ask you for information, sometimes we need middle name, last four digits of Social Security, last known address. That's why. So understand that every time the attorney says, look, I'm trying to clear judgments, it is a process. It's not just simply, well, I got Michael Jordan, and I know this isn't the Michael Jordan. We have to actually have a basis to clear it. And sometimes it means we got to call the other attorney and say, what's the last four digits of your Michael Jordan that you have a lien against? And they'll say 1234 and go, well, our guy 789. So we don't have the same guy. When you have the same common name, you're going to find things. And then it's trying to figure out if it applies to yours or not. And that does take time. That's not something that you just spend 5 minutes and clear it. So I think this is a good example of why sometimes these liens and judgments, even though they don't apply, can delay closings.
Absolutely. And this is, we've talked about this before in a prior podcast about one of those reasons you have to have that tough conversation with your sellers about, you know, their financial condition and whether or not they have any of these types of things out there, because this is going to be something that could cost or could take a long time. And we've had several closings fall apart because the seller ended up having judgments that exceeded the amount of proceeds that they were going to get from the sale. And so they weren't going to be able to pay off these judgments in order to deliver clear title to a buyer. So we had mentioned before in a prior podcast episode is this is why you have to have these tough conversations with your sellers.
All right. We're running short on time. So let's hit number four.
All right. Number four is one I'm seeing an awful lot of lately, specifically like even in the last few months or so. For whatever reason, we're seeing a lot of divorces that are causing title problems. And the reason that divorces are causing title problems is that, you know, your property, your house and that type of thing is sometimes considered marital property. Even if you owned the property by yourself, if you owned it during the course of your marriage and marital funds were used to continue to make mortgage payments and improve the property and those types of things, it could be considered a marital asset that needs to be dealt with the family court. And so what we're seeing is either husband and wife own property and they're in the middle of a divorce, but they don't have a final order yet, you know, dealing with the assets in the divorce, or they're wanting to sell and they're going to split the proceeds, but they're not splitting 50-50. They want to split it 30-70. And again, we don't have a final order. These types of things can cause delays because we'll either need to get that final order from the court, or we will have to get some kind of affidavit from both parties, basically hashing out what the details of the decision are going to be about how the proceeds are going to be split or those kinds of things. So that can be a delay. Of course, you know, a lot of divorces aren't exactly on great terms. And so trying to get the cooperation of your future ex-spouse to so that you can sell this property sometimes doesn't go as easily as we would like. And so that can cause a delay. The other way that we have delays with divorces is you own the property outright or with your spouse, let's say, and then you got divorced 6 years ago. And as part of your divorce order, your spouse was to convey you the property and you were supposed to pay them a cash payment of $30,000, but your spouse never conveyed the property to you and you never made the payment of $30,000. And so now we're in a situation where you're now trying to sell the property and ex-spouse is still on title. So we have to get a deed from ex-spouse, and ex-spouse doesn't want to sign the deed until she gets her money. So there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of time and energy that goes into trying to put these sales back together when we see that there's either a pending divorce or a divorce that happened a while ago that the ultimate result never occurred.
Great opportunity for, well, it's a great opportunity for an ex-spouse to put the screws to somebody too.
Absolutely. And we see that.
Yeah. You reach out to somebody 8 years ago, you were supposed to convey the property and they aren't owed any money, but they're like, well, we're not going to do it unless he pays for college. And you're like, wait a minute. We're not going to get into a negotiation on your post relief here of your divorce, but that's what you'll see. The other thing I want agents to understand is just because it's written in a court order doesn't mean anything. You still got to have the deed to match the record. And a lot of times agents will call and go, well, it says in the divorce decree. Well, I don't really care what it says in the divorce decree. I still got to have that order. I still have to have the deed recorded, putting the property in the proper person. And just because it's written in an order doesn't mean anything if it's not a corresponding deed with it.
Right.
Moving on to number five.
All right. Survey issues. And this is sort of all encompassing. But the number one thing I want everybody to know is that we get a lot of situations where the legal description on the property is so vague or so old that we can't actually legally identify the property. And when that happens, we have to require a survey in order to insure it. And so a lot of sellers get a little mad with us sometimes when we say, hey, you've owned this property for 60 years, but your legal description that you got it from is not sufficient to actually identify this property. And so you're going to have to pay for a survey so that we can insure this for the borrowers or for the buyers. So they don't like that too much, but that's one of the things that we have to do sometimes. And so one thing that the agent can do is pull up the most recent survey that's referenced in the deed for your seller and make sure that it either references a plat or a survey that describes the property, or it has what we call meets and bounds descriptions, which would say, you know, on the north, 135 feet, sort of maps out the boundaries, the measurements of the boundaries of the property. Otherwise, if it just says on the north by Mrs. Smith and on the west by Mr. Blue and those types of things, you can almost guarantee that we're going to require a survey.
We see those a lot, particularly where you have property that was acreage and had been divided. It'll say on the right side by Mr. Jones' property, now or formerly known as Mr. Jones's property. You'll see that quite a bit. And then the other one you might see is a subdivision where you look at it and the only thing it says about the lot is 100 by 50. There's no directionals. There's no how 50 by 100 actually is shaped. And so a lot of those have to get surveys. And you're right. Clients get very upset when you're told you have to get a survey, but you got to convey marketable title.
That's right. So then the other thing a survey does is, you know, a lot of times buyers will get a new survey. And then all of a sudden we look at this new survey and we see some kind of problem on this survey. And this is things like, it could be as little as a fence encroachment. Your fence goes over the neighbor's property line by a little amount. But in some instances, it can be really big things. So my most recent example, my horror story, is my seller had not gotten a new survey at the time that they purchased the property. And then the buyer got a survey on this property when they were going to buy it. And it turns out that the in-ground pool was halfway over the property line when we got that survey back. And that was a long time and a lot of energy and a lot of money spent by the seller to try to correct that issue. Obviously, we weren't digging up a pool. We were going to have to deal with it with the neighboring property owner. And it cost, like I said, the seller a lot of money, and it delayed the closing fairly significantly to get that done. So that would be one of those things that, you know, can cause a lot of delays, but that's also an example of why your buyers should be buying surveys if they can afford it. And if we can make it happen, they should be getting surveys when they're purchasing property, unless there's a recent survey that shows all of the improvements, like the house and the outbuildings and the fences and whatever else is on the property, because the last thing you want to do is go to sell property and then the buyer gets a survey, and now all of a sudden you have this major title issue that you had no idea about, but it's your turn to pay for it because you're the one that now owns the property.
I've seen sanitary sewer lines under people's houses. I've seen storm drainage lines under houses, which are big title problems. I've seen houses on the wrong lot. We had many, many years ago, 20, 30 years ago, I found one where a builder had miscounted the lot from the corner, thought it was lot number 10. In fact, it was number 11. So a whole neighborhood of houses all had the wrong deed. I mean, that took hundreds of hours to fix that problem for the guy. There's lots of things that you can find on a survey. So I've had agents ask me, well, why did you tell me or why didn't you tell me? What is kind of the standard of whether we alert people as to whether these are title issues we can fix or not fix?
Well, I mean, first and foremost is, can I get title insurance coverage over it or not? We kind of start there. But the majority of the time, my personal standard and the standard of the firm is if it's going to be something that I would want to know as a buyer and that could potentially become a problem for me down the road, I'm going to have to divulge this to the subsequent buyers. Or somebody might knock on my door at some point and say, hey, by the way, I actually own this property. We're going to tell the buyers about it and give them the opportunity to say to the seller that they want it fixed or to make the decision to go ahead with the transaction as it sits. Just because we want to treat these buyers as if they were our friends and family and that we wouldn't want our friends and family to buy this property with these problems or whatever it is, without the opportunity to really have an informed discussion about the potential pitfalls.
And a lot of times a closing attorney has to make a judgment call, because if we were to call you every time we see something on title, we'd be calling you on every single title. Because as Erica said earlier, if your name is Jason Smith, there's going to be judgments that show up. If we called you and said, hey, we got 100 judgments against your Jason Smith, you and your client are going to freak out, when in the reality of it is we're probably going to clear all of them, and probably not even your client. Probably it's a different Jason Smith. So a lot of times we have to decide, are these problems we think they're going to be cleared or not going to present an issue? Or is it a problem that is going to be an issue? So if it's an estate issue, if it's a divorce issue and it's going to be we're missing an owner of title, certainly we're going to reach out to you at the very beginning. But if it's a judgment, it's a lien or possible judgment, possible lien, we might not reach out to you. And 99% of the time, they'll get cleared. But there could be that one time where the day of closing, that's when we just weren't able to clear, and it's going to cause an issue. And it's not that no one was working on it. Closing attorneys are already working on it. It just appeared from the beginning it might not have been your client, and when in the end it winds up being the client. So those are things that we just, as closing attorneys, have to kind of make some decisions. The advice that I would give all agents is as follows. When you meet with a seller, you need to ask a couple of questions. You need to ask them, how long have they owned the property? If they say, oh, well, I just got it out of a tax deed, red flag. Immediately pick up the phone, call Blair Cato and ask us, what do we need to do? Ask them how they acquired it. How'd you acquire your property? You've owned it for 4 years. How'd you get it? Well, I got it from an estate. Red flag. Or my mom died and I got the property. Or, it came from an estate. My sister didn't want the property, so she gave it to me. Another red flag. So when you start seeing these things outside of the typical norm that I bought the property from another human being, you need to start asking those questions. Also ask who all has owned this property since you've owned it. If they say, well, I owned it and my ex-spouse owned it, well, now we got an issue about the divorce. Or I owned it and my late husband owned it. Well, now we have an issue with an estate. And then the last question we should be asking is, you always ask mortgages because you're sitting there trying to figure out a net sheet. You should be asking these things. Do you have any liens? Do you have any judgments? Do you have any tax issues that we need to know about that could affect it? Because what you don't want to do is list a $500,000 property for sale, get it under contract at $500,000, and find out that the person owes $800,000 in judgments and liens and they can't sell it. You've wasted all of your time. You've wasted your marketing dollars, and you're just going to create people that are going to be upset with you on the other side because you didn't do your homework. So I think that's the whole key here to make sure that this doesn't happen. Last word, Erica.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. And again, I just want to encourage you to, for those of you who are representing buyers, that you encourage them to really look at the survey and whether or not they can afford to go ahead and get that survey. Even if you're in a platted subdivision, a lot of times there aren't individual surveys showing the house and the fence and all of those kinds of things. And that's traditionally where we see the large majority of the survey issues, is where fence was built 10 feet over the lot lines, or the house is within the minimum setback line, or a utility easement, or things of that nature, which become very big problems. So that's my other kind of last ditch advice, is if you have a buyer, to encourage them to get a survey if there is not a current survey showing the house and all the rest of the improvements.
All right. Well, great information. I think we should just come up with another podcast. I'd like to do like the top 10 horror stories of title that you and I have seen over the years, because I've got some fun ones. That would be a lot of fun to make. And I think agents would find it enjoyable, interesting, and scary at the same time. So Rebecca, until we meet again, you're quickly becoming the number one guest on the show. So until we meet again, thanks for being here again.
Thanks.
And that's all the time we have for our show this week. Appreciate Erica coming on yet again to Dish and Dirt. Looks like she's about to become a regular on the show. And we will try to have her on again next week as we go over owner financing and bond for title issues. And then, as I said, we'll jump right into 2023 and what we expect the 2023 market to look like. Don't forget to like us, share us, and subscribe, and tell all of your friends all about Dish and Dirt. But most importantly, don't forget to send all those closings over to Blair Cato so that we can keep this show rolling right along. Hope everybody has a great weekend, and we'll see you again next week for another episode of Dish and Dirt.